We are joined now by Philippe La Rochelle in Montreal, and I assume. Philippe, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here in Montreal.
Hey, thank you very much for being with us, and I'm sorry we had to delay slightly. We're having storms in Toronto, and we had issues in reaching people. So you have led the defense of a gentleman from Rwanda. He'd been in Toronto, pardon me, not Toronto, Canada, for a period of time. But he was charged with genocide, and a decision was made to try him in a Canadian court. Yeah. And the trial began last year. It finished in March, and lo and behold, your client was acquitted. Summarize why you think he was acquitted. How did it come? What was it about that case that caused the that acquittal?
Well, it started off as a huge balloon where there were allegations that he committed several dozen murders and at least a dozen sexual aggression. And this thing deflated to become a case where there was no direct evidence linking him with any crime whatsoever. So in the process, what became obvious was that a massive amount of fabrication had taken place. Mm-hmm. And the judge, I've been working on the Rwandan case for the last 12 years, and this is a first in that the judge acknowledged that fabrication indeed took place concerning the allegations that were made against that man.
Mm-hmm. You know, this has been argued in relation to Rwanda, as it probably could be in other similar types of situations where you had the kind of war and violence that went on, is that the people go into courtrooms often for motives have nothing to do with the individual who's charged, but who want to achieve certain results. Is it true that your client was here a number of years, and of course he had entered the country and had been visited by authorities over a long period of time, experienced no difficulty until he had agreed to be a witness for the defense in another case. Is that true?
Yes. There is an interesting coincidence. And there was a case in the United States about a man who hailed from the same area. And at some point, Mr. Mungwai was announced as a witness there. And we got disclosure of the initial contact to the RCMP. And I think it's a matter of days between the day where the name of Mungwai surfaced in court and one of the witnesses that had traveled from Rwanda to USA tipped in the RCMP to start this investigation back in 2003.
You know, after all that time, surely they were noticing that they had problems with this testimony. My understanding is the judge he said it clearly, and I think you repeated it, but that it not only were individuals involved in fabricating, but it was like a group effort to produce false evidence.
Yeah, it was survivors from the area. It was actually, the prosecutor knew long before we started trial that this was the dynamic in this case, because the first recanting witness denounced several other people with whom he had colluded to fabricate that evidence. And not only did he denounce it, but he also alerted the defense and the parties, I would say, about certain salient features of that fabrication. For example, the fact that, you know, they all agreed to put him in a military outfit, to put him with guns. It's a bit sad, if I may. You know, what I realize is that the dire poverty in Rwanda is a very strong incitement to use the genocide for people that are desperate to leave the place and go somewhere else. And why I'm saying this is that the name of Mungwain was not significantly mentioned in all the proceedings at the ICPR. You're talking about five or six cases dealing with the same events. And all of a sudden, you see this sort of, these enchères, sorry, this is French, but they're sort, you know, it's like, who's going to say the most violent things about him? There was some vivid descriptions of sexual violence and crimes that you had never seen or heard in none of the cases about Kibuye Bisesero in the past. And all of a sudden, the case in the USA where six witnesses went from Rwanda and three remained there in the USA created that dynamic when the Canadian policeman went a few years after. I suspect that they didn't want to miss the train that time on. So you see that gross exaggeration that is taking place in all of the statements that could have been easily identified, mm-hmm. you know, early on if the prosecutor had access to the prior statements of these guys. But that's another problem that the ICTR, the Tribunal in Arusha, is absolutely not forthcoming in sharing the fruits of its investigation for the last 15 years. So
that is a problem in jurisdictions, isn't it? There often is a kind of we hear this about police departments. They don't always share. They believe it's their property.
They don't know where to go. They don't know what to do. They don't know where to find the information. Whereas if you've been exposed to the ICTR, you're going to immediately locate and look at the judgments that were rendered on this issue, and you're going to find immediately where there may be problems with regards to the evidence. So, but you're right that we can get that feeling of being a bit at loss from the police force when they started doing that investigation.
Mm-hmm. By the way, of course, there's been the press seems to be a little bit astounded. I think they all had it in probably the stories almost written that he was convicted. So they were a little confused in the way they reported. Are you comfortable with some of the reporting? I know that they've used odd language about him. There might have been a French to English issue. Some papers said he could not be proven guilty beyond all doubt, instead of saying reasonable doubt. And I know I've seen letters to the editor getting confused. The judge did say reasonable, right?
Of course. There's more. I mean, you know, I don't know whether there'll be an appeal or not, but definitely the comment about the probability is a bit is interesting, not to say to say the least. Uh-huh. But you know, it's hard to. It's so difficult to comprehend and to assess any sort of evidence coming from Rwanda. There's a whole cultural dynamic that is, I think, beyond the grasp of not only the judge, but also the lawyers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let me just say that, you know, the judge did not accept his alibi. The judge did not accept the alibi at all, in fact. So let's see what the prosecutor makes of that. But, you know, what the argument was, what would you do, you know, faced with people that are alleging that you committed massive amounts of rapes and murders, mm-hmm. And you see that the prosecutor insists on bringing these people on, even if you have what I would say the most strong conviction that these people are simply telling lies.
Yes.
It's just how I mean, you're not in a normal setting to make inferences or to properly and comprehensively and exhaustively assess the evidence. It's very difficult.
Yes. By the way, I mean, again, I'm very impressed with the court work of you and your team, but particularly because it may help many people who are immigrants and refugees who are not believed, and your court, this judgment helps them establish the fact that yes, there are people who will come and lie and make their lives miserable. I mean, that has to be taken into account.
Yeah.
You also had expert witnesses for the prosecution who acknowledged that there is fabrication.
Not in such strong terms, but let's say he did not rule it out.
they didn't come over to you, but they had to acknowledge it. I know that Professor Renschens has several times given evidence about this. He's regarded as one of the people, and he's caused the prosecutors some headaches because while he has been a prosecution witness, he's also said there's no doubt that the Rwandan government and others connive to produce false evidence.
Listen, this is my third Rwandan genocide case, and there's not been a single case where there's not been, tested acknowledgement by witnesses of fabrication by the, you know, that in my, all my three cases, they were recanting witnesses. You know, one of the law emerged and could not bear it anymore, fled Rwanda or did not flee Rwanda and had to come forward and provide the dynamics that explain why they were willing to fabricate evidence very easily against somebody who's living abroad or who's no longer living in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. It's just, unfortunately, you know, if the problem is that the main source for this information is the ICTR, and they're carefully hiding it all. If somebody at some point, someday, somebody would be allowed to comprehensively obtain all the amicus curiae and all the incidences of recantations and intimidations and phony business that's going on with the genocide evidence in Rwanda, it would unfortunately bring a very poor or it would bring out a lot of problems about the evidence that was heard at the ICTR, but in other countries, and it's probably why they are keeping it very close to their
yes,
their chest, and they're not revealing it at all.
Yes, your work, such as yours, is embarrassing them. If I could ask you quickly, Philip LaRochelle, Victor in the case in Ottawa, what about, are you anticipating an appeal, and is your client at liberty?
Yes, the client is at liberty, and as for the appeal, the procedure has 30 days, so we'll see, but there's been no indication that there would be or that there wouldn't be an appeal at this point.
Well, that's very important, and I do think it's a great day for this country that this is, you've established so many important facts in this case that will be of help to everyone. Philip LaRochelle, we're sorry we got to you late, but we're really glad we got to you.
No problem.
Okay, thank you.
Good evening.
Bye-bye. That's Philip LaRochelle. He represented the accused, Mr. Mungweri, You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. I want to thank Phil Connan, particularly for all the information about the rail situation. By the way, Phil and I will be doing a Friday morning, 9 a.m., on CIUT, and we're going to come back to this subject, and Phil will give us some expert report on that disaster in Quebec and India, et cetera. Thank you.